Hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us. You're watching Securing More with Less, Smart OT Cyber Strategies for Lean Times. Today, our expert panelists are Roger Hill, founder here at Hillstrom, and Mike Holcomb, OT director with Floor Corporation. This is a live event. We welcome your questions. If you'll put those in the chat, I'll monitor those and we'll get to them at the end if time allows. Again, thanks for being here. Hope you enjoy.
Good morning. Good morning. Great to be here with you, Mike.
Well, you too, Roger. And thanks for Kara for the introduction there.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation. And so it's great to have you on here. So I think everyone pretty much knows you, but would you care to introduce yourself, Mike?
Yeah, my name is Mike Holcomb. I am the fellow for cybersecurity over at Floor. For folks that aren't aware of Floor, we're actually one of the world's largest engineering and construction companies that's out there. So we actually build, engineer, oversee construction and sometimes operations and maintenance for some of the world's largest control systems and OT environments. And so I get to help with securing those environments as being able to act as the OT cyber lead for the company and work with our clients that are some of the largest companies in the world like Shell and Saudi Aramco. So that's what I get to do in my day job and also post educational material for folks that want to learn more about OT cyber, whether they're just getting into the field or they have they're responsible for an OT environment and they want to learn how to build their program out. So I put that content out on LinkedIn and YouTube.
So Mike, I've been seeing a lot of your content on LinkedIn and I have to say that I think you've just done an amazing job for the community, especially for the folks that are just coming into the space. You've really helped creating blueprints, if you will, of where do you get started. And it's been a much needed gap. And I just think you've done a phenomenal job there.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that.
I'm curious. I'd love to start off with just kind of hearing about your personal journey. How did you get to where you are today? Before we kind of dive into the nitty gritty.
Sure. And I was telling this the other day, and I realized it. I took way too long, so I'll try to get the more abbreviated version because I do ramble. But I actually grew up with a hacker kitty, who was my best friend, and so I would watch what he would do. He would like crack games so you could copy them, and he would write cheats so you get like unlimited gold or unlimited lives. And I just thought that was always fascinating. But I was a good kid. I would never do anything like that. And so as I grew up, it really started to get into this idea of I was always interested in computers. And then, of course, saw War Games, which got me interested in, kind of the hacking aspect. And I had this connection with my friend Chris. And I always wanted to do something with computers. But there was also the security aspect, even though nobody talked about security. And there was no such thing as cybersecurity, right, back in the day. And that just always really stuck with me. My first job was in IT. I actually ended up working in the mall in LA for a couple of years while I was going to school. And I worked in the back of the clinic. Yeah, so I was actually doing electrical work a lot of times, and learning notebooks, learning the hard way that, if you touch this, you can get shocked if you don't, unplug the machine. So I guess I do have a little electrical technician background there, but I got and computers worked, I've worked in IT and in cybersecurity for 30 plus years at this point. But when Stuxnet came out, which you're very familiar with, I heard of that and I was just like, wow, this is really fascinating, right? That not only was it breaking systems down and in the real world, but how it hid that malicious activity, right, from the operators, right? And they thought everything was okay. I just was really fascinated with that. And so that got me asking, like, well, how does this work in a power plant, or how does this work in water? And I had friends that worked at, power and water in San Diego, and but trying to have those conversations, it's like nobody wanted to have those conversations, and it became readily apparent at the end of the day, it was doing anything about cybersecurity, right? And they just didn't know. Some still don't know, right? That they need to do anything about cyber in these environments. It's very frustrating getting started. And so that's why I started posting the content and writing the courses and putting it out there for free. So that way that people out there, don't have to, just don't have to be frustrated. If they want to learn about OT cyber, you shouldn't have to be frustrated. Even if you're just coming to learn about it a little bit and say, hey, this is for me, or maybe it's not for me, right? I'm going to go do something else. Awesome. Right. But at least you shouldn't be frustrated to be able to find some material to learn the basics. Again, whether you want to get in the field, maybe you have an environment, you want to build a program, how do you, improve your existing program? And that's really the idea behind that. So that's kind of where I got to today. So I just was really lucky to get the job at Fluor. Was when I applied for it. And this was literally just after Stuxnet, which was funny. And I loved my job at the time. I was doing pen testing, breaking into environments, loved my job, hated my boss, and had got a call, you want to come work at Fluor? Sure. And then realized, yeah, we're one of the world's, giant engineering companies. So I work with some of the best engineering minds in the world, and the triple PhDs and the books and the patents, and I get to, I could just ping somebody and say, hey, can you? I remember, getting on a call when I started hearing about like GIS data, and it was like, oh, I call up like the top guy in the world for GIS data, right? And have a conversation with him. So those, yeah, I really lucked out in that case. And I realized that. So, being able to share that type of experience with others, that don't have that opportunity, then I think it just makes it that much more worthwhile.
It's amazing how the Stuxnet event has really been the epiphany moment for so many,
Right.
in our community, and it was for me as well. I'm an old industrial guy who, worked for Siemens for 16 plus years,
Right.
I definitely consider that the burn the bridge moment of going from really the design and engineering of industrial control systems. One of the things I loved in my journey working for Siemens back in the day was just working in so many different industrial verticals. My handicap before starting my career at Siemens was I always got bored after about a year. And the one thing I can honestly say, I never got bored because I was always thrown into a different industry, different sector, different problems. And I mean problems. I think it's just really interesting. But, one of the things that I think is interesting is looking at, for example, how you're trying to help the community. People getting into OT security. The one thing that I am seeing is just the great need of breaking down the silos. I think historically we talk about the OT IT battles, but I think this is what's interesting about a journey is it's all of your personal experiences in your personal journey that influence your opinions. And for me, being on the side, so many different sides of the coin, if you will. So from the designing of systems to taking the offensive side of OT security to securing the systems, but also on the product security. So having been involved in secure PLC design architecture of the PLC, but also on the SCADA side. So I think all of that just kind of influences your opinions of how you view problem sets, right? And we can't ignore you know, the anniversary date here.
Right.
I'll bring it up first. And I'm going to tell just a little interesting intro story, if you will. So 4 years ago, I was just, I just left Rockwell Automation, and I was starting over at Kudelski Security, working for, my old friend, Andrew Howard, who is the CEO at the time, and a bunch of the ex GTRI guys, right? And I was starting on Monday, and I think it was on a Friday or Saturday when Colonial Pipeline happened. I live in the Atlanta area, and I had to drive downtown for my first day at work. I couldn't find gas. And on the local news, we saw some of these ridiculous things, like people pouring gas into the back of a pickup bed. So when we talk about the impacts, you know, I think it's really interesting. So I'll kind of start that conversation with my personal story and my personal story of being impacted by that event.
Yeah. We all were on the East Coast. Right? Yeah. I think it was 70% of the East Coast was impacted. And that's why it was that watershed moment where people realized, oh, there is a real world impact out there. And there's this thing called OT that we rely on in our daily lives. And the owners and the operators, thankfully, at that point, the vast majority realized, okay, you know, maybe we've been ignoring this. Maybe we didn't know we needed to even think about it, but they at least know now that they need to be thinking of it. Doesn't mean, you know, right? There's a lot of environments out there that just don't have the resources to do what they need to be able to protect their environments. They can't do everything, but at least they're now starting to realize that, yeah, we need to do something about cybersecurity for OT, right? Because unfortunately, the other, you know, bad thing with Colonial Pipeline was the attackers also realized there's this thing out there called OT, and if we attack it, right, we can get paid faster. We might even be able to make more money. Or, you know, for a hacktivist, right, we could just want to cause problems and get our message out there. So yeah, it was definitely another one of those where it was a double-edged sword. So the good and the bad. But thankfully, you know, I know like at Floor, ever since Colonial Pipeline, we have those conversations with every single one of our clients. Before Colonial Pipeline, it was probably 70% of our clients, right? But there was still 30% where like cybersecurity just wasn't even, you know, on the agenda. So.
Yeah, it's amazing. In 2025, I'll still work with some clients in the global manufacturing space, and we'll just leave it at that, where they're at the early inception point of building out a program. And I think it's really interesting to kind of think about what does a program really mean in a lot of these sectors? And, you know, I think let's take the Colonial Pipeline as an example. There's so many in our community who say, oh, that wasn't an industrial control system attack. Sure. Was the impact the same? Sure as that was. If production is shut down, then it had that physical impact. So my personal viewpoint, and this is where I've changed quite a bit, I think, in my approach to the problem set, is I think most of the ransomware type of events doesn't need to touch the it doesn't need to go south of that industrial game scene. And coming from a software development background, what I can tell you is I think hackers and coders are very much alike. They're inherently lazy. And I mean that in the most respectful way, actually.
Sure.
Because it's about being efficient. If I can accomplish my mission without having to go further, why would I?
Right.
Right. So I think it's not just the ones and zeros that are transmitted from, you know, the site supporting systems and the ERP and everything else into the shop floor, you know, where the carpet meets the concrete. It's the indirect. And I think that's such a gap in, and I address this a lot because I'm on a pulpit here, and I think it's really important that as a community, I think there's some people that are doing just an amazing job of really looking at the risk of industrial control systems at that industrial DMZ and south.
Right? Yep.
The challenge, though, is then you've got on the north side of that, you got the IT folks doing their thing. Mm-hmm. What we're not really considering is the who is responsible for looking at the indirect. Yep. And often I think that's a gap, and that's where I think it's a danger of these silos of IT, OT. And I think it's 2025. We need to converge in that unified mission.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I get to go into a lot of environments in the day job. I do side work. So I get to go into even more environments. You know, it's a lot easier to go into a manufacturing plant in the Carolinas rather than a petrochemical facility in the middle of China. So I prefer I can drive to the plant. I've seen the good, the bad, just like you, right? And everything in between. It's a beautiful thing when IT and OT come together and they're working together and they see things from each perspective, right? And they're learning and sharing and they're getting the job done. Actually, I had a gentleman who runs one of the largest critical infrastructure environments in the United States. And he was talking about the problems that he had. He had been pretty new to the job. He had inherited the environment, had been there for a couple months. And their number one problem was IT and OT weren't talking to each other. Yeah. It's like we just throw these events basically over the fence and to the OT team and we don't get a response. Like, have you talked to them? They literally, weren't. And we see a lot of that out there. My girlfriend, she's a marriage and family therapist. So I've always just seen it as this, it's like a really bad relationship with your wife, your husband, your partner, right? Boyfriend, girlfriend, right? If you're at each other's throats, right? It's miserable and nothing's getting done. If you're not communicating, right? It's miserable and nothing's getting done, right? And at that point, the attackers are winning. Right. We've got to work together. And that's why I really like events like, we did B-Sides ICS this year for the first time. And it was, partly bringing people in from both OT and IT and all different levels of experience and just mixing everybody up in the same room and being able to, let's first, realize we're just all people at the end of the day, right? That want to do the best for our environments and keep them protected. And if we can just look at those commonalities and just kind of build off of what we have in common, I think it goes a long way into being able to work together to protect these.
100%. One of the things that I try to do for my clients, as an example, is really encouraging and building out steering committees or advisory boards where you have the mixed, you're bringing in the different personas from OT and IT, those different domains of discipline. I think it's so crucial because once everyone understands, hey, it's a unified mission, then you have that cross-pollination of experience and it changes that collaboration in solving that mission. So I think it's just so crucial. Mike, I do see that we had a question here from the audience. Given the severity of the consequences of Colonial Pipeline and potential consequences of business interruptions, why do companies not prioritize OT security commensurate with the risk? Good question. Mike, do you want to take a stab at it first? And I'll give my two cents.
It's one of those where it's a big it depends question. Honestly, when I got out of IT cybersecurity full time, one of the biggest things I was really excited about was I didn't have to worry about security awareness, right? I didn't have to teach people, or you know, take the time to teach people, help them understand why cybersecurity is important. And then I got into OT cybersecurity, and I realized, it's actually an awareness game, because whether it's the folks that work in the plant, whether it's the folks on the OT cybersecurity team, the IT cybersecurity team, or if we're talking about working with executives and other leadership to get buy-off and support for a cybersecurity program in OT, it's the vast majority of it it's an awareness game. And the best thing I think that a lot of environments should do that they're not is look around and see what's going on, right? Like with Colonial Pipeline, since we're talking about Colonial Pipeline, it's funny because there was a other pipeline operator that had the almost exact same issue, like less than 2 months before that. So if I was working for Colonial Pipeline, right, I would sit there, right, and say, hey, oh, look what just happened to our competitor over here. And are we protected against that type of attack or not? And like, if we're not, we need to do something about it. I think if most organizations even just did that, they would be much further ahead of the game. So the same thing we saw with the port of Nagoya, right? They went down because of ransomware, largest port in Japan, shut down pretty much for 10 days, right? What happens, 6 weeks later, I think about that, it's most of the ports in Australia went down because of the exact same type of incident, right? If you're running the Australian ports and you see Japan just got hit, it's like, what could that happen to us? I think a lot of people could get a lot of benefit just from watching what's going on out there. Yeah, at a general high level and what's going on in any environment, but it really even sinks home much more so, especially with your leadership, to say, hey, right, we're a pipeline operator. Did you just see what happened to Colonial Pipeline? Right, want to make sure, like, we're not protected against that, right?
Yeah.
We have the same problems. We need to, we need to fix it, and this is how we can fix it, but we need your support to do it.
It's those conversations that are interesting. And I'll give my personal opinion here. And I think it goes back to the silo problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Big part.
I want to take a step back here and talk about safety for a moment. Safety for with such a focus in the operational side for industry for so long. But it was an operational scoped discussion and problem set that was solved within a singular domain or silo. So it was solvable. I think when we're looking at the cyber physical impact and securing those, now we're talking about several domains or silos that are part of the equation, right? So you have operations where it's actually happening. You have the CISO that is responsible for cyber, but then you have the chief risk officer that is responsible for enterprise risk, right? So the question becomes, where are these conversations taking place? Are they taking place? And are they going, is it commensurate with what needs to go to the board? And I think that's the fundamental problem. And that's why I spent so much time talking about tearing down these silos, because that's the challenge is, I think the conversations are happening, but are they happening at the right place?
Yeah.
And are they taking the right form?
Yeah.
It's a very difficult problem set, especially for these large Fortune 500, entities that they have 100, 200 sites globally. It's a very challenging environment. That's kind of the way I think about this is how do we put together the right type of programs where we're rolling up the insight of what our risk is and in terms that are understood to that C-suite? How do we ensure that the COO, and I see that there's a new persona that I just stumbled across recently. It was on LinkedIn, actually, Chief Manufacturing Officer. So I wasn't even familiar with that, but I see there's quite a few of those titles. So I think when you look at the Chief Manufacturing Officer, you look at the Chief Operation Officer, Chief Risk Officer, CIO, CISO, all of these need to be having the right conversation. So I think that's the root cause, in my opinion, of we need to address risk in a commensurate way.
Absolutely. And it can't, be done in a vacuum, which is, part of what you were touching on, because, who's having those conversations, if they're having those conversations at all. And it's like, well, we need to make sure that everybody's in the room that needs to be there. Yeah, absolutely.
So, listen, like one of the things that I see as a definite 2025 problem, right? And I'd like to hear what your feedback has been in dealing with, your clients. Everyone I talk to is simply underwater. There's one common characteristic. Everyone is trying to do so much more with less. There's been freezing of headcount that was previously approved, but they didn't act fast enough to execute on the budget. They're still having to execute. So everyone is just at this just state of what can I actually get done? And are you seeing something similar with your folks you talk to on a daily basis?
Yeah, so the larger companies with the more mature programs, I think they have the support that they need. Sure, they're still like everybody. They're super busy, but they have a strategy. They have a plan. They have a program, right? So everything is moving according to their schedule, right? But that's not the reality that the vast majority of organizations out there face, no matter how small or how big they are. So yeah, everybody's not only super busy, but at the end of the day, I think there's still, there's a lack of education. Right. There's a lack of awareness. There aren't many true OT cybersecurity professionals out there like yourself, right, that have an engineering background, that understand control systems, that understand cybersecurity and how to bring those together to protect the environment. Right. So I think there's so many environments out there that just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Right. Or at least what to do next. Right. Or where do we start? And then unfortunately, there's even the majority of the environments, there's small mom and pop shops that they don't have somebody that's responsible for OT cybersecurity. They don't have somebody for IT cybersecurity. They might not even have anybody for IT. Right. They have to call Joe or Jen down the street to come in and help them on a case by case basis. And that's, and I always think my grandfather, he was the power guy and the water guy for a small town in the middle of Kansas, 800 people, right? If there was a problem, they called Earl, right? And Earl, right, he didn't have the time to worry about cybersecurity, right?
He used to work with Earl.
Right. Right. And usually it's Bob, right? But I think we still see that a lot these days. Yeah. I mean, I when I get to go into different environments and kind of touch, it's really exciting. And I can see like how much work it is. And yeah, I mean, the people that run these plants, I mean, it's all about, keeping them up and running and making sure, the clients are getting power, clean water, or we're able to get food to the stores so you can get food on your table. And that's the main mission. And it's like, now we have to worry about cybersecurity. It's just one more thing to add to the list that, there's no budget for most people, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of merit to that. But I think it's also, if we take away some of the mystery of just the word cyber, right? I think it causes a lot of folks some angst. I can tell you on the industrial side, if we just think about some of the, the engineering processes that we have in place, right? In the same way that when we're designing a new line or and we go through that factory acceptance test, you know, we have to think about the HACCP and the processes that we are utilizing to actually design the different interlocks because of events, you know, failure mode effect analysis, whatever process we're running. A cyber event can actually trigger the same impact. So we need to look at this from a different lens. And one of the things that occurred to me back in my Siemens days when we were building out the security business is no matter what controls that we were integrating, security controls on that industrial control system, whether it was on that process control network or the control system network, field device network, it was always an overlay. It was never truly integrated.
Yeah.
And for example, the disconnect here is I think when you look at the industrial control systems, rarely are you taking syslog events into SIM, right?
Right.
There's a multitude of reasons, right? I think one of the primary reasons is on that process control network with the PC-based systems. Yes, sure, you have application security events that you take out of the OS, right? You do need to have some unique correlation rules that are focused more on operationally centric versus DNS centric, right?
Yeah.
But I think the biggest reason is once you get south of that process control network, 80% of the devices, they don't support any type of security eventing, right?
No, right.
So it's a layered approach. So one of the points that kind of occurred to me early on is if you think about the alarm management philosophy of a SCADA system, right? It's all about your process events. Mm-hmm. And there's really interesting analytics you can run on this today. So you can actually determine, hey, this one level sensor that we're utilizing, we've had excessive failure rates. Maybe it's time to look at a different type of sensor, right?
Right.
What we never overlay is if we have some events, right? We're never integrating. And I always thought that would be so fascinating if you could merge the alarm events, the process events with those cyber events and correlate the time. That would be a really interesting analysis.
Right. Yeah.
That's an example of it's a bolt-on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and there's folks that are trying to do that, and I think we're getting there. So it's really fascinating to where you can get the true big picture. And not only in the OT environment, but then how does that line up with IT? So I want to see everything, you know, overall from big picture. Now, I just want to see also OT by itself, right? So, you know, I don't want to see everything all at once, and that's all I'm going to look at. I'll still just focus in OT. But and I think we do have... I think there's a lot of momentum there because you can really, I've had a lot of great conversations, you know, being able to like market, I guess, not that I'm selling right product, but you know, the idea of SIM in OT, not for cybersecurity, but bringing in event data where it's available, like you said, not all systems, but where you have it and you can use it to identify operational issues. Right, especially hopefully ahead of time, where it's like, right, we see, maybe there's a turbine over here that has an issue and it needs maintenance, right? So it's, we can use SIM to help from an operational perspective, and then, win-win, right, on the back end, right? We're also using it for cybersecurity, but, you know, maybe the business or the the operators don't care about that, and that's okay, but if we get cybersecurity out of it, so much the better.
You know, I think that's an interesting idea, and that's the idea of fusion. So, you know, that's something that we're looking at as well, right? It's about fusing these different sources into having a unified view of what is that visual transformation? What is that data? Because data is just data. It's not valuable until it becomes information. Right? And that's really the trick. You know, and I think that's an interesting thread, but I think one of the things that we need to fulfill maybe the promise of our discussion today. And that's, what's the message out there of what you can do when resources are constrained, budgets are frozen? You know, what are the options out there? And maybe even on that SMB, you know, that small, medium-sized business, manufacturer or a water treatment facility. What are your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I look, you know, and again, I go into environments all of literally the largest to the smallest and everything in between. And there's a lot of commonality still in many of these environments. I always gravitate to, you know, a lot of the material that Rob Lee has put out. And I remember going to his grid class in 2017. So I was taking his grid class as Trisys was actually literally happening. So you can imagine that was a really interesting time. But I remember that was the first time I had seen his sliding scale of cybersecurity for OT. And anybody, you don't have to go to the class to look this up, because SANS makes it available as a white paper. But the idea is, you know, you have different types of controls that you can apply. But ultimately, the question is, what can I apply today, right, that's going to reduce my risk the most? And you can use it to depend, like, on your environment, right? Some, if I'm a company like Shell, right, I'm much more mature, right? I'm much further down the path than a company that has done absolutely nothing for cybersecurity. So, you know, most environments, and Rob makes the comment, right? They don't need zero trust, right? They need a firewall, right? And it's true. Right. And so the first thing that we always typically will look at is doing network segmentation. Right. And I was just in an environment not 2 weeks ago that full flat network, nothing standing between IT and OT. Right. And so, and there was a cloud component as well. So not only, you know, could somebody in IT, you know, have a, become infected and take down the OT net plant, but it would be really easy to bring that in from Amazon or Azure, you know, whichever cloud service they were using. But so it really starts with, yeah, looking at where you're at. If you know, for example, you're brand new, you haven't done anything for cybersecurity, right? It's still very common to see environments that, yeah, there is no firewall between IT and OT. And that's where we would start. Because when you think the number, you know, one route that attacks use to get into your OT network is through IT. So if you don't allow any, what's that?
No, absolutely. I agree 100%.
Yeah. So if we don't allow any IT traffic into the OT network, we just blocked the vast majority of risk, right? I'm not saying we're done, right? But we just blocked the vast majority of risk. Now, can we do that in every environment? No, right? Now we can do it in a lot more environments than people think, right? But if you know, we always have that data in OT that we want to send to the business that they can use to run the business, right? If I have a manufacturing plant, I need to understand, right, how much did we manufacture today? So I can do things like coordinate shipping, right? Logistics, storage, right? We want to get that data from OT to IT. But if we don't, you know, have to allow IT to come into OT, then we just reduce the vast majority of risk. So, I put in a firewall there.
Yeah, let's double click on that one just a little bit, right? Because I think that's 100% agree that segmentation is probably one of the first and foremost things. Getting that separation from the IT to the OT. If that's not there, definitely get that in place. Mm-hmm. Ideally, with an industrial DMZ, where at least within that DMZ, this is that sandbox of the resources that are. It's the go-between IT and OT, right? It's very crucial. I think in my opinion, today's world, I haven't seen many sectors where there's not a business justification need of having some connectivity. We are looking at so many dynamic supply chains and production planning and scheduling and maintenance systems, the reality is there is a business justification for having connectivity. Now, having said that, what's really, really crucial in my opinion is that often when a lot of folks are doing assessments at that facility, check, there's a firewall. You better look at the policy.
All right. Yeah, look at the rules.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen a firewall that was actually just the world's most expensive switch.
Right.
There isn't any rule, right?
So right. It's
understanding what is that business justification and what are the policies that you have in place to actually determine change control and who is managing that change. I think that's the reality. It's a complex issue.
For sure.
Now to make the problem even more compounded, I should say, is when you look at a lot of the industrial automation vendors that are going cloud native now, Mike, they're developing automation components that are cloud native.
Right.
So listen, this isn't, I don't think we can just shut off IT and OT. I think it's more
not at all.
Having that controlled environment and doing it in the right way. And one of the things that's always troubled me about every security diagram we've ever seen for industrial DMZ, think about where a DMZ actually originated from, right? It was a demilitarized zone, right? It was a sandbox for your public facing resources for like web servers and things like that, right?
Yep.
So at some point, this really got morphed in a terrible way in our community because we started putting security management controls like AV, virus definition servers and patchet servers in a DMZ.
So right.
Maybe we ought to take a step back and question what we're doing here in that DMZ. And maybe it's the classic constructs of this Purdue model. It's more about having defined control between the industrial, whether it's a control system network, field device network, process network, where you have your security management separate. It's kind of the out of band.
Oh, for sure. Right? Yeah, it just a bit. We could spend 40 hours on an architecture conversation. Where it's, again, it's so many environments just don't even have that firewall. And then it's just a matter of, and this kind of goes back to the idea of having a program or a strategy, because like, okay, well, now I have a firewall, now what? Right? I need to review the rules. Like, okay, we better do that. Right. And then, maybe we do get to the point where we do need to have a DMZ that sits between IT and OT and look at what resources we can deploy to control that traffic that moves between IT and OT. And I realized, we're going to have an environment that's going to have traffic coming in from IT or from the cloud. That's great. Like, I'm not going to tell you no, but you need to do it as securely as possible. I think there's a lot of people that, if you don't realize that an IT environment is going to become compromised one day, then you're fooling yourself, right? You're just burying your head in the sand. Yeah. And the same thing is true for cloud. Every cloud environment is going to be compromised, right? Just going to happen, right? We've already seen the biggest companies and the biggest cloud environments with the best security teams in the world have all been compromised, right? Multiple times. Right. So if you think your cloud is any different, it's not, right? So just work under the assumption that those environments are going to be compromised. So how do you protect OT from that when it does? Yeah. So all comes down to incident response planning. And hopefully that you're doing network security monitoring, which, as Rob has been really highlighting over the last year, right? Less than 5% of organizations globally in OT are monitoring their networks, right? And I always say probably half of them aren't even doing a very good job. So it's, we're not watching. So it's like great. You want to have IT traffic coming into OT. You want to have cloud, you know, traffic coming directly into OT. Okay, right? But we need to add those additional controls to do it securely.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, just to maybe piggyback on the segmentation issue, because I think that's one of the first things that you do in terms of like a top five. But I think it's also, security is all about people, process, technology. And on the process side is how frequently are we requiring the audit of those firewall policies, right? And who's conducting that audit? And what, one funny story I'll mention real quick is this is an oil and gas site where it was really interesting. The IT security folks, they had the separation of their firewalls from their vendor applied at the plant level. The plant put another, their firewall,
I've seen that,
but... down of that, where they own that policy, would even show InfoSec that policy, and that policy really just implemented blockers for some of the Nessus scans. So, you know, I think it kind of goes back to the whole the infighting. But, you know, I think when we peel back the onion a little bit, this is the way I would really state this, is when you think about blocking the IT to OT in terms of the threats, let's face it, 99% maybe of threats are really going to be coming from IT to OT. So really focusing on that segmentation and not from a technology standpoint, but also from the process and people. Now, outside of that, there's another vector that I think in industrial systems we have to be very cognizant of, and that is our partners in the edge, right? So when we think about how engineering work takes place, it takes, like, for example, when you think about a planned scheduled downtime, that parking lot is almost as full as when they're running production, because they have an army of integrators and contractors flooding the facility, and they're trying to get as much done in that 1 to 2 week outage as they can.
Right.
So the point being, when we have integrators and solution partners that are coming in and performing work, what are we doing to determine, hey, are you allowed to bring your laptop in and connecting to our infrastructure? The media, right? That's another threat vector that we have to consider. Not to mention that there's some of the building control systems and wireless systems of, you know, so there's more than just the classic IT to OT. It's really the edge and personnel as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, what are people bringing in? Like, the last thing I always think about, like, our folks going into a plant with their laptops. I'm like, I could, I wish, you know, we had clients that said, no, right? We'll give you a laptop, right? That we secure, that you don't have to worry about. I would not want to be responsible, right? Or, yeah, people bringing in the USB drives, or every plant I go in these days, right? Someone's got a smartphone plugged into, you know, an engineering workstation to charge it, but it's like, it's a cell connection, right? Let alone it could be compromised, or in just about every plant these days also has a contractor coming in and dropping a 5G connection, you know, so they can get into their systems remotely, or even a Wi-Fi connection, right? That they're not talking and they're not telling you about, right? I mean, it's every environment I see these days, unfortunately. And then it doesn't even bring in secure remote access that a lot of environments are just leaving open 24/7. I had one client, they had a remote access account for that was 24/7, 365. It was a shared account amongst like 30 people at this contractor. And basically once you connected, it allowed you to go straight down to level one. And it was just like, let's have a conversation. Oh, why, right? This is not good. It goes back to a lot of it. It's just, they just don't know, right? They're just trying to do the right thing, right? Contractor says, hey, it's in our agreement. You give us, you know, access at this level. And that's what it meant to them.
You know, there's another form of vendors to really consider. And this is the reason that it's important when you're doing an assessment to open every control cabinet.
No, for sure. Right.
There are so many DIN rail mounted, modems that are connected where maybe that machine builder, they have a feed and connectivity that is another remote access. And the one thing I think is interesting with radio is he who has the strongest signal wins. So it's actually really interesting to do some man in the middle effects. So,
I've been at some sites that, you know, it's like, oh, have you considered, you know, with the Wi-Fi or because we see Wi-Fi, right? And other types of RF in so many environments. And like, well, what are the considerations? Like, oh, well, you know, our plant's like way out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's going to drive out here. Like, oh, no, they will drive out here, right? you know, they're out there in the tree line. Maybe it's 2 or 3 miles away, but they can still do damage.
Mike, we might want to get into, I see that there's quite a few comments out here. We should probably dive into a Q&A session here. So let's see, there's a gap in understanding on cybersecurity mission. I couldn't agree more with that. So I think that's an interesting one. How do we solve that? And I think it starts with bringing, you know, the different parties together and having that discussion about the mission. What I really like to do is, you know, we've used our own internal framework, but I think NCCOE really did some interesting work there in terms of the profile for NIST, specifically thinking about the mission being five pillars, ensuring product quality, ensuring product safety, human safety, environmental safety, and the information related to the process, if you will. In that, if you think about those five pillars, one of the things I like to do is talk to folks about, as a security control, one thing that we will commit to is that with the mission, those are the five pillars. And if we're not aligned with one or multiple of the pillars, it's not a control we should implement. And that, I think that's one technique I'll throw out there as one that I have found to be successful in kind of bringing the sides together and talking about the unified mission. But in my perspective, I think it's about having that conversation. And I definitely agree with that comment about the mission.
Yeah, I think I do want to explore more as time. I think there's more where you really need to play therapists. You know, again, this goes back to, you know, my girlfriend's background, but being able to play the therapist, you know, kind of marriage therapist between IT and OT, or just a different party, right? Every environment's different, but you know, it's usually IT versus OT, and being able to get them to work together, and then I think there's also a big awareness and education component as well, and those are two different things, but people need to understand, you know, some of the risk, right, and what can happen. And I think I've had a lot of traction explaining to people that, oh yeah, most small, medium-sized businesses, it doesn't matter if you're in IT or OT, if you have ransomware and you shut down for 10 days on average, chances are you close your doors in 3 to 6 months, you don't have a job. That's a big eye opener for a lot of people. And they said, oh, you know what? Maybe we should start to care a little bit more about OT cyber, right? We can talk about, right, safety and availability, and but at the end of the day, it's, yeah, you could lose your job, let alone, yeah, somebody could get hurt or somebody could, you know, get killed.
So I see it. There's another one here. I think it started with a comment of that we're bringing up some interesting conversations on the NENE rules of firewall. And is there any research that has looked at OT environments and reported what percentage are configured correctly versus what percentage have issues and what is the Pareto analysis of those issues? So let me just say that I would probably be the first to love to participate in that type of research or reading the research. But the reality is, I don't think that research could ever take place because no one is sharing the information. So when you have inside an internal organization and you have two internal groups within the same company that won't even share the policy internally, you know, you have a bigger challenge with no one on the outside is going to get access to this rules from an analysis perspective. I think that's the unfortunate thing. I love the idea of being able to analyze this as a greater problem set, but I just don't think it's realistic in my opinion. But Mike, maybe you've got a different opinion.
Yeah, no, it's hard. Yeah, because you're not going to have somebody be able to go in across all of them. I think if you talk with people that have looked in these environments, there's always an issue with the firewalls. I went into a big plan environment one time, one of the largest in the Western Hemisphere. And the plant manager was really excited to show me his firewall. And he takes me in and he opens up the cabinet. It's like, those are Cisco catalysts. I'm like, those are switches, not firewalls. You know, that, and I think that's just an example of, it's, you see these, Patrick Miller at the Level Zero conference, I mentioned, because I actually did a presentation and I was talking about firewalls and how bad they are because of rules. And so instead of a picture of a firewall, I had a picture of a dumpster fire. and he's like, he's like, why did you do that? And then he's like, one time we went into a plant and there were 17 any rules, because every time they had a problem, they just kept putting it in there and not even taking out the old ones. So it's really bad out there. I've seen some decent ones also, right? But those are the more mature organizations. But I would say, and one of the, leading cybersecurity OT companies out there, when they do their year in review report, I don't know if I can say the name or not, but they, they mentioned, and this was year before last, but out of all their clients and all their engagements, including their penetration testing engagements, right? And they go into some of the most mature organizations and all over the spectrum, but they were able to get into OT from IT 70% of the time, really easily. And that really speaks to probably, you could probably say roughly 70% of access control lists on firewalls and 70% of those environments, you could probably make a correlation to that, that there are issues in the majority of firewalls that are out there. And I think if you talk to anybody that, like yourself, that's gone into any of these environments and looked at those rules, that actually probably sounds about right.
Yeah. I think, here's a good closing one, I think. What's your views on pen testing in OT?
Well, So I get in trouble when I say that, because first of all, I love pen testing, right? I love going in and just trying to take control over everything in IT environments, right? When it comes to the OT world, it's very different, right? When I'm talking with businesses, right, a pen test is the last thing you want or need, right? It's very expensive and it's only going to show you maybe a few issues, right? Invest your money in other places, unless you're a very mature organization, right? And you've done everything else, right? Okay, then go have your pen test done. But then we don't even pen test in production, right? Because we could potentially bring down the plant, or we could get somebody hurt, or we could get somebody killed. So I would, and I've been offered great deals to do pen tests in production. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I just won't. There are people out there that will, for sure. They'll take your money. And I hope their, E&O insurance is off the charts and they don't get somebody hurt or killed potentially. Does pen testing need to be done for more mature organizations? After you've done everything else, it should be at the bottom of the list, because again, it's very expensive and it's only going to show you maybe a few risks. Is it going to help you increase your cybersecurity? Sure. But is it going to, increase, the strength of your program or decrease your risk as much as the firewall or the DMZ that we're talking about? No, of course not.
So I think this is where it's so interesting, the journey. I used to be hard-nosed, Heck no. In fact, the only way you can do it is if you have a sandbox that's a replication, virtualized version of your actual system.
Ideally, right? Yeah.
Yeah, do it there, right? This is where I've evolved a little bit, right? When we're looking at the different controls, it's not about the controls. It's about how well are those controls architected, configured, and tuned, right? Then what's really crucial is the validation. And that is where a focused and well-scoped OT pen test that is validating a control effectiveness can actually be very valuable. For example, you just deployed your new DMZ firewall and got your new policy. If you scope your pen test where your starting point is from a point on IT and your mission is just to get into the DMZ, and the evidence of that is that you can prove that you can identify an address of a node in that DMZ, that success and go no further. And I think it's really important because that's one of the values of a pen test is understanding those threats and the effectiveness of the controls that you do have. Because that's one gap that I do see is when you do have your controls in place, how effective are those controls?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I just think it's, if you're going to, there's a lot of companies out there, right, that are going to charge it, even say low end, like $20,000 to do that, right? And most of these environments, they just don't have the 20 to spend. Or if they have the 20, they need to spend it somewhere else rather than doing pen tests. Now, if you could find somebody to do it at a reasonable price, great, right? But that's just not the case, unfortunately.
Well, Mike, this has been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation. I don't know if anyone else in the audience did, but I sure did. But
definitely. No, I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite to definitely. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you everyone for participating today in really good questions.
Yeah, no, thanks everybody for coming along for the ride.
Thanks for joining in. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. Thanks, Roger and Mike. We appreciate it. If you had a question that didn't get answered, please send me a message on LinkedIn and I'll get an answer back to you as soon as possible. For more information, go to hillstromsecurity.com and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.